Welcome to Fronteras, a Changing America. I'm your host, Vanessa Dalbovich. Latinos are the largest ethnic minority group in the Southwest and the fastest growing nationally. More than one-third of Latino students are English language learners, and according to Department of Education data, they consistently perform poorly on state tests and have lower graduation rates than whites and Asians. On today's program, we focus on the Latino achievement gap in our region and explore how states are looking beyond federal guidelines and assistance to come up with possible solutions to close the gap in the Southwest. An estimated 1 in 5 children in the U.S. speaks a language other than English at home. In most of these homes, that language is Spanish. And yet the vast majority of these children are taught strictly in English at school. Some educators believe this is part of the reason Latino children are lagging behind in school. Reporter Jill Replogle from the Fronteras desk tells us about a growing movement in California to educate children in 2 languages.
The playground at Los Altos Elementary School is on a hilltop. To the south, you can see across the border fence that separates Mexico from the U.S. to the neighborhoods of Tijuana. In the other direction, you can just make out the skyscrapers of downtown San Diego through the morning haze. Many of the kids at Los Altos are familiar with both of these worlds, and some will grow up fully fluent in the languages of both.
Excelente. Rodillos a rodillos. Empieza a platicar.
This year, Los Altos started a dual language immersion program. These first grade students spend half of their day learning in Spanish and the other half in English.
Penguin can survive in Antarctica.
It's not exactly a radical concept. Bilingual education has been around probably forever. But dual language immersion programs are distinctive. Here, students take classes in 2 languages throughout their grade school years and sometimes into junior high and high school. The aim is to strengthen the first language while teaching a second. Other California public school programs aimed at English language learners have a different goal.
To get students into English as quickly as possible.
Christina Alfaro is a dual language literacy professor at San Diego State University.
So really never allowing children to fully develop their primary language, and then they are pretty much just put into English and you go back into the sink or swim.
Many students sink. California Department of Education statistics show that English learners score lower on standardized tests than their peers. Fewer graduate from high school and go on to college. But recent research shows students in dual language immersion programs tend to thrive, often surpassing the test scores of their peers by the end of primary school. Some California educators think these programs can help bridge the Latino education gap. Plus, they say the world has changed since California voters decided to virtually eliminate bilingual education in 1998.
You have to look at, ultimately, what do we want these children to be? Do we want them to be able to compete in a global market? Yes, then it makes sense to maintain their language.
Thanks to positive results, dual language immersion programs are catching on. California schools have added around 100 such programs in the last 5 years. Some 50,000 public school students are enrolled. Most learn Spanish alongside English, but some programs offer Mandarin, Korean, and German. Parents at Los Altos are thrilled. Sofia Diaz has 2 children in the dual language immersion program. She says her daughter, Ana Sofia, loves the program. She can switch between English and Spanish fluently and with good pronunciation in both languages, without any ums or ahs. English-speaking parents like Maria Elena Blankenship also love the program.
It's been wonderful. The Spanish has become more confidence in her to be able to speak it. Mm-hmm. And to be able to write it is even phenomenal.
Many dual language immersion programs are located in wealthy neighborhoods where highly educated and involved parents demand such programs. But Los Altos serves a lower middle class, largely Spanish-speaking community. That's where parent education comes in. At a recent Latino education summit in San Diego, Christina Alfaro ran through an exercise with parents. They discussed the positive and negative aspects of different educational models for English learners.
If they don't have the right information, they don't know what to ask for.
Despite their increasing popularity and apparent success, just 2% of English learners are enrolled in dual language immersion programs in California. California law makes it difficult for English learners to receive instruction in their native language. And because dual language immersion students often score lower on tests during their early years, some schools are wary of implementing such programs. They're under federal pressure to continually improve their test scores. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
Nationwide, Latinos attend preschool in lower numbers, dropout rates are higher, and fewer Latinos get college degrees. But for Hispanic girls and women of college age, that gap disappears. Studies show that American Latinas now attend college and graduate at a much higher rate than their male counterparts. Their college success rate is nearly equal to that of white men. Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez reports on a Phoenix program that focuses on young Hispanic girls and their main sources of educational support, their mothers.
Hoy nació el Señor.
Mom, I know you can sing. Why are you changing your voice?
Denica Gonzalez and her mother Reina have a strong relationship. They sing in the church choir, they go shopping together, and they spend time in Denica's room talking about school, friends, music, and Denica's future. 18-year-old Denica is a high school senior. Among other things she and her mother do together is participate in the mother-daughter program at Arizona State University.
It teaches you how you can prepare yourself for college with your resumes, how to do, like right now, the personal statement.
The Hispanic mother-daughter program started in 1984. It's one of three programs in the Southwest. The other two are at the University of Texas, El Paso, and in Austin. The program brings girls in as early as eighth grade, and it's competitive. Hundreds apply, but at ASU, only 140 are accepted. Anita Tarango oversees the ASU program.
Because the program has been around for a long time, people are very familiar with it. And they know our success and the impact that the program has made in many families.
We want you to succeed.
The students attend workshops at Arizona State University. They learn everything from time management and leadership skills to creating career plans and public speaking. And they must attend all the workshops with their mothers. Tarango says without that involvement, the girls would flounder.
Having someone in your family who can guide you through the process, I think it's very important that these girls have that. And that their families get on board.
More than half of the girls who enter the program end up attending college. That's a success. And there's been another more unexpected outcome. Mothers not only want to support their daughter's quest for college, many want to go to college themselves. Denica's mom, Reina, who stopped school at eighth grade, is one of them. As they say, there's no age limit to school. Reina half-jokingly tells her daughter, Denica's all for it.
She's like getting a second chance to also go to school. That's what I liked about the program. That's why she was so happy about it, too. She's like, tengo otra oportunidad para ir a la escuela de nuevo and everything.
This mother's story is one of many. Program organizers don't focus on the mothers, but recognizing an opportunity, they've created a How to Start School session as part of the workshop for the moms. And already a handful of mothers have gone back to school and actually graduated from college alongside their daughters. Again, Program Director Tarango.
They get exposure to not only the workshop topics, but the actual physical place of ASU. They start to see themselves as university students.
We want to look at these programs as like a move in the right direction, but not let ourselves get too comfortable and realize that there's still a little bit more work to be done.
Alex Trillo is a professor of sociology and Latino studies at St. Peter's College in New Jersey. He's written on the issue of Latino educational achievement and is part of a federally funded project to increase Latino college attainment. He says this is just the first step in a long process.
We want to inspire people to think about more competitive schools and get involved with more competitive programs. I think that's an important next step once folks start really benefiting from the kind of program that we're talking about today.
Support systems like mothers and programs like this seem to be part of the package of educational success for many Latinas. Trillo and other experts would like to see programs like this one expand to other states with large Latino populations. Meanwhile, Denica will go to ASU for her undergraduate studies, starting in the fall. She wants to go to medical school at UCLA. Her mother is registering for English classes. In Phoenix, I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
New Mexico is becoming the latest state to be freed from the No Child Left Behind grading system. While the state may be free of the federal system, the recently implemented state A2F grading system left Las Cruces schools with less than stellar marks. Nearly two-thirds of New Mexico schools received a grade of C or better under the new ratings by the Public Education Department. Las Cruces Public Schools was a bit bottom-heavy with C's and D's, but Superintendent Stan Rounds says that isn't necessarily bad news. Glancing at these numbers, about half of them, you know, 50%, are Ds or lower than that. It seems like we're at the bottom end of the spectrum. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, what we did, we think that given the statistical model that's being used and all the parts that we understand so far, Las Cruces should expect to look like a bell curve. So you should see the median grade at C. And so I would agree that we are below that expectation right now. And I wouldn't use the term greatly below, but slightly below, because I know about some schools that are what I'll call on the bubble as far as being within a couple of points of the next grade that would bring us closer to that standard deviation model that I would expect to see. Now, of course, we want to be better than that. And I would indicate that, number one, this is a simulation on a first set of data that we're still going to be studying pretty deeply. In fact, all of the information hasn't come to us yet. As we've broken down the data we do have, we know that the lowest quartile kids, the lowest performing kids, were actually doing an admirable job of increasing their learning, the pacing of their learning, faster, which is really what the requirement of making these grades higher is. So if you're a kiddo that's in my schools and you go to school for a year, we expect you to gain a year's worth of knowledge, right? That's what this model's built on. The model says if you do that with all your kiddos, that you're going to get a C. Now, because it has some components to it that really force that question, it's called value-added model. So it's how much value did he add in the current year, as well as how are you doing on the test in relationship with your peers. So it really does get into that issue. So it mediates. It gets to see if you go at the pace you should. Now, the way you get better than that is to learn more than you're supposed to learn in a year. And now remember, it's on a three-year average for a large part of this. And so in 3 years, you would expect to grow three grade levels. If you grow 2.5 grade levels, you get a D+. If you grow 3.5 grade levels, you get a B-. Okay?
Okay.
And so as we start looking across, you look at your lowest performers, that lowest quartile, the last group of kiddos, and we're really moving them faster than a year. In fact, doing it pretty dramatically in some cases in both reading and math. So that was good news to us, because under the old system of No Child Left Behind, that was a targeted group. And we learned how to really put resource and targeting into them. And I was very gratified to see that we grew them very well. We also in the district have been working at the upper 10% kids, the highest end kids, to be sure that those moving on to in that area are also not being forgotten, that we continue having that acceleration. And again, this early data looks really good, that we're moving out even more quickly with them too. So what that really then forms as our thesis question is, what happened to the rest of the kids? There's about 65% of the population that are the rest of the kids that moved along slower than they should have during that time. That's how you got a D. My suspicion is that if a student was approaching a year's worth of learning over a year and they weren't in those two target zones, we tended to figure that was okay. Now, that's not an excuse. In fact, that's, I think, a pretty good wake-up call for us, that you have to look at every child's progress and not become complacent because they're doing okay. We need to pray, I think in our system, we need to pressure ourselves to be more reliably focused on every student's momentum as well as their achievement.
How do you feel overall about this state system replacing the federal one?
Oh, I feel like it is a better system. I feel like it is going to give us more consistent queuing. I have some detail issues that I want to vet out a little more and enter into some dialogue with the folks in Santa Fe about that. I'm not certain what I'm seeing. That's why I'm waiting for the rest of this data, because there may be some slight modifications to how they do it that might be reasonable. I mean, it's that middle kid question. It appears to me that if your middle kids move out at a year or just less than a year every year for 3 years, where they have a very small backslide, that it significantly impacts you statistically, and I'm not sure that's reasonable. So, but as compared to the old system, I like it better. I think it's more clear. I think that people understand A to F. Here's one thing it does do that the Secretary of Education has said it would do, and certainly it does. It doesn't automatically trap every school in Las Cruces to being a failure, which the old system did. Because what it required was that every student, whether you were a special needs child, whether you had other significant educational impact issues, you had to become proficient at a certain level with all of your peers. And if you missed even one of 38 measurement categories, even one that you didn't reach proficiency in, you failed the entire system. So what's 1/38? Is that about 2 points? Is that right, or 2.5 points? So if we got 98% of the deal right and failed 2% of the deal, in other words, we got a 98, we got an F.
Oh, geez.
You only got 100, did you get an A? This system's different than that, and I think that's good. I think it also may vet out some issues that we hadn't normally looked at in our systems about how we accelerate kids' learning. And it's going to challenge us. I think it should challenge us. It may be something that would be very positive for us educationally here in Las Cruces to challenge ourselves to accelerate students' learning and make sure they're learning faster than we were allowing or we were plotting, I guess, for their learning curve. With the Common Core coming, I think it's going to be very incumbent on all of us to take a critical look at our delivery system, at our expectations in the classroom, and look at how we can accelerate to higher levels of learning faster with every one of our children. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's a great challenge.
How do you feel about the role that standardized tests play into the grading system? Do you think that's an accurate way to go about this?
Short answer is yes, I think. No, I think the standardized test may be too heavily weighted. But let me qualify that because, here's the issue as I see it. I think there are two kinds of things. And the first that isn't there, that I think needs to be there, is more formative evaluation work, which is code talk to mean you're mapping kids as they move along the way to find out if they're pacing like they should. We have a test right now here in Las Cruces called Measures of Academic Progress, MAP testing. Every student from grade 3 through grade 12 take MAP testing. And the data that I saw in these grades are very close. To draw very close conclusions to what I think I see in our MAP testing. And MAP testing is clearly focused on pacing. It's that question of, is the kid learning a year's worth in a year? You know, at the end of the year, it's too late to know. If you know along the way, that's what MAP testing does. You take a test at the beginning of the year that marks where they are, one at the middle year that's the same test that measures where they're at that point, and one at the end of the year that measures the year's progress. And you're able to see how the pacing goes. And when you do that for 3 years, which is what they're looking at in a good part of this protocol, that means you would have 9 tests instead of 3 to let you see how the student's pacing along. And so I think that's the part that isn't there where it needs to be exactly yet. What I know is with the Common Core, the test protocols being developed nationally for that will have both that part, and then they'll have the summative part, which is what you're seeing now on NMSBA, which is summative evaluation, means at the, you know, at the end, it is what it is. And then you measure summative to summative to summative. That's what they're doing right now. And I just don't think that's enough. It doesn't let you move instruction along, because we've got to challenge ourselves. Every year, every class is different. Every year, every class is different. The other thing that's not in this system to the level it might be is cohort measurement. Now, what does that mean? That means if you and I are children in this system, right now, as you and I move through, we get measured against the other folks who are in other groups moving through at the same age we were at that time, or when they were our age at that time. That's not cohort. Cohort is measuring your growth and my growth as we move through time to see if it's paced properly. And that isn't in this system. So this is this year's third grade against last year's third grade against the third grade. This is last year's third grade against the previous year's third grade against yet the previous year's third grade.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
See what I'm saying? Instead of taking the first graders 3 years ago and measuring with second graders and then now measuring with third graders and seeing how they're doing as a body. And that's an issue within the system that I think should have some bearing. Because it's part of the equation of whether or not your instruction is doing what it should. So that's where I would see maybe a deviation. It's not that I don't support the system, I just think we might embellish it or improve it. And I think that the Common Core, when it gets here, with what because I'm working with a lot of the national test design people right now, I'm very lucky to be on some superintendents panels, that's where it's heading. So it probably fixes itself out there in time. But right now, that's not real good.
Next week, the interview with Superintendent Rounds continues as we address the issue of just how far to push students without having an adverse effect. I'm Vanessa Dalbovich. Thanks for tuning into Fronteras, a Changing America.